that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Welcome to season two of Three Associating. We're back. This is a podcast that goes behind the door of therapists working in a relational psychoanalytic model. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Rachel. We're both therapists.
And we're both supervisees of Jill.
And I'm Jill, therapist and supervisor, co-author with Jackie Winship of the book, The Talking Cure.
While people might think that therapists have it all together, by now you've discovered we don't. We get stuck, experience challenges, and have blind spots. And these persist.
All of this continues to affect our work. And this is where relational psychoanalytic supervision comes in.
And this podcast will give you a peek behind the closed doors of relational supervision, focusing on the therapist's blind spots and how it affects their work and their ability to help the patient. Whereas traditional forms of supervision focus on the patient and how the patient affects the therapist, relational supervision complements this by focusing on both what the patient and the therapist bring to the table.
In each episode, we will explore a relational dilemma arising in the context of work with a fictitious patient.
While none of these patients are real, the relational dynamics are. Episode 1, Game of Cards. Hey, Rach, you know when you're at a party and someone says, I'm not racist, but, and then tells a really racist joke?
Mm-hmm. Or they say, I'm not sexist, but then say something really sexist.
Exactly. Well, I'm not that guy, but I just was that guy.
I want to jump right in today because I just had an experience with a patient in a recent session that has stayed with me that I want to work out a bit more.
Okay.
And actually, the feeling that I'm left with is one that was similar to a while ago. I was involved in a game of cards with some friends and one of my friend's children. And the friend's child was about 12 at the time, so just on the cusp of adolescence. Mm-hmm. And we were playing cards and he was winning very well and I was losing very, very well. And so he was sort of making fun of me and we were engaged in this banter, which felt fun and lighthearted. And then the tables started to turn and I started to win and he started to lose. And so I kind of kept up the banter and was saying things like, oh, look who's losing now and that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden he burst into tears and ran away from the table. And I was left just realizing that I was the adult in the room that had just made a child cry. I'd sort of pushed it too far. And that's the feeling that I'm left with after this session. Yeah, so I'll jump in. So I'm going to call the client that I'm working with Brad. He's in his late 30s and he's involved in property development and is involved in a family business that carries his surname and his father's surname and his father's father's surname. So,
okay.
And I've seen him weekly for the last year. He initially presented with depression, particularly low mood and irritation and lack of motivation. And in his own words, he said that he felt weighed down by dickheads was how he expressed it.
Sorry, weighed down by?
Weighed down by dickheads.
Dickheads, so, okay.
Yeah, by all these people around him that have been idiots. Mm-hmm. He'd originally planned to attend an ayahuasca retreat in Mexico, so that was how he wanted to kind of shift things, but COVID made that impossible. So he sort of feels like he's stuck with therapy until he's allowed to leave the country and go on this retreat. He has two children that he knows of, he says. He's got a 7-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter. He's quite disinterested in the daughter and he's invested in the son, but he's quite punitive and harsh on him. And Brad has been with his wife for 20 years. They were kind of high school sweethearts. And I don't get much of a sense of the wife, but it feels as though she could be described as long-suffering because Brad's quite challenging. What he says he wants from therapy is a space to vent. He says he needs to unload, otherwise he thinks he's going to explode. And he tends to blame others if he doesn't get what he wants. He often feels treated unfairly and he's unable to see any part that he might play in that. His father also passed away 18 months ago And Brad doesn't really see this as an issue, but it does seem that working under his father contained Brad and protected him from himself in particular ways. And now that his father's died, people tend to tolerate Brad less. I would describe Brad as defensive and prickly and confrontational and argumentative and quite disinterested in self-reflection. And so in many ways, he's the embodiment of what we could recognize as like a toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. So he's quite closed, he's quite dismissive, he's quite aggressive, he's blind to his privilege, he wants to be right at all costs, he responds to difference with prejudice, so he's quite racist and misogynistic and homophobic and all that kind of stuff. And he also doesn't play by the rules. Mm-hmm. So the first time he went to pay me, he paid me in cash and said, "You're welcome, you know, you don't have to declare this." So, of course, I make sure I send him receipts. So it's quite interesting because I think that we're both the type of male that the other would actively avoid. And in our work together, there's almost like an active disdain for each other that fuels our work. And I find him quite offensive. So I've had to work hard to try to connect with him and to find a part of me in him. I've been able to do that through understanding a bit about his family history. So he was the oldest of three children. He had two younger sisters, and he was really bullied by his father. So his father was highly critical and treated everyone pretty terribly and tended to get away with it. So his father was physically and emotionally abusive towards the mother, especially when he'd been drinking, and he would tend to taunt Brad. So Brad has memories of trying to get in between the mother and father when they were fighting, and the father would say things like, "If you want me to stop, then why don't you stop me? Come on." Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And Brad has memories of, you know, waking up the next morning after an altercation between his parents and everything would just be back to normal. So he has a memory of sort of hugging his mum as she cooked breakfast and she wouldn't look at him and then she'd tell him to sit down and eat his breakfast. So there was like nothing talked about and everything was swept under the carpet. So in our work, I've been conscious of having to be sort of tough enough to earn Brad's respect so that we can engage in some more tender work. And I think there's actually quite a lot around loss and sadness, but he's absolutely not able to face into this. And so the flavor of our work has been one of confrontation and sparring. And he tends to challenge me around lots of different things. So he's challenged me around my fee, the session length, appointment availability, what I wear, different questions I ask him, progress. He's very challenging. And in all of the challenging, the image I get is of a child who's pushing really hard against my hand. And he pushes and I push back and it's sort of like we have to do this until he's exhausted and he's found me strong enough to contain him. For example, he might challenge me in the progress that he feels he's making in therapy or the lack of progress. He might say something like, you know, "This is going nowhere, nothing's changing." And I'll respond, you know, "Well, you know, therapy's a process and not everyone can tough it out. Maybe it's not your thing. You know, if you're not tough enough to stick with this, that's okay. There's no shame in that." So all of this has been pretty successful in developing a pretty robust rapport between the two of us. And I don't think he would ever say it, but I do feel that he feels that he can trust and respect me and that he does derive some benefit from our sessions. So what happened the other day was he came in and he looked a bit disheveled. For him, he usually presents.
Can I just ask one question? How long has he been coming, Andy?
For a year.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, that's okay. So he came in and looked a bit disheveled and he sort of fumbled around as he sat down and he said, So where do we start today? And I sort of said, I don't know, where would you like to start? And he said, I don't know, I don't really know what to say today, I feel a bit lost. So he was kind of vulnerable and fumbling in a way that felt very unusual for him. And then I heard myself saying to him, I said, "You know, you don't know what to say, you know the rules of the game in here, buddy. You know, you talk, I listen, we work things out, and the longer it takes you to say something, the less time we have together. And look, the clock's ticking, you know, we've got 48 minutes left together, and if you don't like it, there's the door." So after I said this, he looked genuinely wounded, and then I saw him gather himself up, and then he launched into a tirade about feeling angry with someone. And so I feel quite ashamed of what I said to him, and I feel as though I missed this opportunity to do more tender work. And I fear that in this therapy, I've come to embody the very type of toxic masculinity that I find so problematic in him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's where I'm at.
So, Andy, did it come back into the session what he was upset about and why he was feeling disheveled?
No, it didn't, unfortunately. I think we missed that opportunity because after I kind of attacked him, then he just changed gears and talked about how angry he was with someone. So, yeah, it feels like we missed that opportunity.
Yes. It's interesting that you use the word attack because I think that goes back to what was happening with your friend and the child, that, you know, you then felt there too that you'd gone too far. But prior to that, particularly with this patient, it seemed to have served a function, the kind of ritualized banter between the two of you. And often with a person like this, there's something important about establishing respect rather than liking or empathy. So, you know, the classic term of you dissing me being the worst possible crime. So he seems to be in that register. But then the trust was built and he wanted to change register. And you're saying that something in you wasn't flexible enough to read that quickly enough and go along with him.
Right.
Okay, what do you make of what I've said thus far, Andy? What do you think was happening that you sort of got caught in the ritual and weren't able to move?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but I know that it feel like even reflecting on it with you now, I feel as though I became someone who I'm not. Like that's not me. You know, I'm not that sort of toxic male. I'm not that sort of person. So it feels very strongly like not me.
Yes. And yet I was so struck in the beginning when you said you had to work very hard to relate to him and to also find a part of you that was like him. That's actually what you said.
Right.
And now I think, unfortunately, Andy, what we're contacting is that the toxic masculinity is you. It's not a not me. It actually is a me, but you've dissociated it and don't want to own it.
Mm.
And therefore it went to an enactment. And as you were telling me about the kind of banter between the two of you, it seemed to me that there was a certain enjoyment in the robustness of the discussion, which then can edge over, as it did, into something more toxic because it closed down vulnerability and tenderness, which I suppose is one of the characteristics, perhaps, of toxic masculinity, is not going there in regard to tenderness and vulnerability.
Mm.
So it feels to me as though you discovered a part of yourself that was enjoyable, which was perhaps more robust. Well, attacking is a strong word, but certainly a robust enjoyment of a kind of banter and not engaging with the vulnerability. And that might be for a change because possibly you spend a huge amount of time engaging with vulnerability and could have been enjoyable not to, but then, you know, something happened in terms of a missed opportunity.
Right. Right. That's interesting because I think that there was a sense of me getting kind of swept up in something or carried away by something. And I think what you're saying about that sense of enjoying something, enjoying a part of me that I couldn't quite own as part of me and that I dissociated from.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how sometimes the patients do help us. We try to help them find different parts of themselves and trying to come to terms with them and to be able to own them. Mm. But occasionally, as has happened here, the patient helped you find a part of yourself that you hadn't quite owned. But I think, Andy, it's because you hadn't quite owned it that it emerged in an enactment, because I think if you were more comfortable with the part of you that can potentially be in toxic masculinity and not need it so much to be a not me part, that it might not have gone to an enactment. You might have been able to catch it sooner.
That's so true. It's interesting, like even as we talk about it now, it feels very difficult to lean into that as being a part of me. Like even just reflecting, I'm like, oh no, that's not the sort of therapist I am. That's not the sort of person I am. But it was in that moment. That was me.
Yes.
And it can be me.
And you came up with a great quote when you and I were chatting in a different context from Freud, And I can't remember it exactly, but probably you can, about how we'd be a lot better if we weren't. Just tell me the quote again.
Oh, yeah, it's paraphrasing, but it's something along the lines of we'd all be a bit better if we could all be a little less good.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that that's to the point here, because if you were less invested in the good, not toxic side, then actually perhaps the session would have gone a bit better. So I think that that quote seemed to me to be to the point. But on the positive, there was something about the way in which you earned his respect, which did allow him to feel safe enough to bring in the vulnerability, because you said somewhere in our session now that you did feel that he actually trusted you. And, you know, I think he did. And then interesting that he goes to talk about somebody he was angry with, not you, of course. You know, in case he gets another sharp retort. But I would imagine that he was expressing his anger towards you in a displaced form. And then that took over. And perhaps the safety about letting go of the defensive anger to return to the vulnerability didn't emerge in the room. And perhaps the fact that you were feeling guilty then preoccupied you, because it's of note that you also didn't return to invite him to start again, you know, for you to say, well, you know, I think I was a bit harsh, or can we start again? Because I do think you're trying to tell me something important that hasn't been in the room before.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I agree, I didn't do that. And I think there was a sense of like, oh no, I've become him, or I've become his father. Like, even now thinking about it, it's like, oh, I became someone else, as opposed to there was a part of me that emerged that is a part of me. And if I'd been able to kind of hold on to that, then I could have corrected it more easily, I think.
Yes, it's very strong, that, isn't it? I became someone else.
Yeah. I'm really having trouble owning it, Jill.
Yes, I know. Well, you know, join the club. None of us really want to own those bits that we don't really like. We didn't disown them for no reason. So.
Right. But also, I mean, it's interesting you say those bits that we don't really like, because there's also a part of me that obviously does like that and gets enjoyment from it. So exactly. I think that's the bit that I find even harder to own, is that part of me enjoys that. That's
a great pickup, Andy, because yes, it's a double disowning. Not only am I disowning the part, but I'm disowning my enjoyment and the fact that I like it, but it, clearly I do.
Right.
So I think that was a really good pickup. So are you okay enough for us to end in a minute?
Or? Yes. Yeah. No, it's been useful to think it through with you, and I feel like I've got more room to move now within myself, and that will transfer into the therapy, I hope. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how he starts the next session. So to be continued.
To be continued. Sounds good. Thanks, Jill. Okay.
Thanks, Andy. Bye for now.
Bye.
In this next part of the episode, we reflect together on what happened in the session. We identify the dilemma we took into the supervision session, and then the blind spots that emerged.
Blind spots include bright spots and dark spots. A bright spot is when we are blinded to the overall picture and can only see a sliver of what is occurring in ourselves and in the interaction. A dark spot is when the issues are more completely out of sight.
We finish by reflecting on what we distilled from the session and then move on to teaching points. Okay, Andy, what was your dilemma going into the session?
The problem that I brought to Jill was that I felt that I'd become someone who I wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Someone you're definitely not.
Definitely, right? Definitely not me. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Definitely not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the distillation, what did you come out of the session with?
Well, I think I realized somewhat begrudgingly that I was put in touch with a part of myself that I really didn't want to own, but that really is a part of me. And if I'm being totally honest, a part of me that I secretly enjoy.
That's the hard part, huh? The secretly enjoy part.
Yeah, the hard part or the best part, depending on how you look at it.
Okay. And Jill, the blind spots, let's start with the bright spot. What did you see the bright spot was here?
Well, I think Andy's really pointed to it. I think he was dazzled by the enjoyment of being the bad guy and the pleasure of power plays when winning, maybe not so much when losing, but definitely when winning, not to mention the eroticization of aggression, which is a very seductive brew.
Mm-hmm. And the dark spot?
Well, I think, Andy, you were blinded to the vulnerability in the situation. And being blind to the patient's vulnerability, I think we'd agree that you crossed a limit for him. And he felt very vulnerable. And then you felt vulnerable yourself and perhaps were unable to step back and repair the situation.
Andy, what were your learning points?
So there were three main learning points for me from this session. The first was related to the Freud's idea around, you know, if I can be less invested in being good and own the part of myself or the parts of myself that are really difficult to own, then I'm not going to get into so much strife. The second learning point was around the importance of being open to what emerges in the session and the rules of relational engagement changing unexpectedly. So not to come in so much with my own agenda, but rather being open to what emerges. And the third learning point was just around how resistant we all can be to really inhabiting and taking on what we think of as not me, even if we intellectually know it is me. It's another thing to emotionally own it. And I'm thinking here of you particularly, Rach, in terms of the therapist as sex object episode from the first season. It's like, you know, the harder we push something away, the more likely it is that it's absolutely there and haunting us from the side.
Very true. And I got to laugh, Andy. I noticed that in the first two learning points, you were speaking in the first person and the last one. it was, we find this really hard, all of us.
That's true.
Somewhat distancing.
That's true. It's not, yeah, it's definitely not me. It's us. It's us. All of us. Yeah. And I really thought of you in relation to how hard that is in your episode.
Not me.
Yeah, definitely not me. No, not me.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, Jill, what were your teaching points?
Well, I thought there was a great example of displacement because when Andy had offended the patient immediately started talking about another person that he was angry with. Again, not you, Andy, definitely not you. So I thought displacement was illustrated. I thought that it really, again, pointed to Bjorn's point about going into a session without memory and desire. Meaning by that, not that we've forgotten the patients, but that we don't remember too much previous sessions, patterns of relating, so that we can be open to what emerges in the particular session that we've just started. And finally, I think that when true intimacy and authenticity are being defended against, we can get into ritualized ways of relating, which in and of themselves then are signals of a lack of intimacy and authenticity.
Okay, so I've got a question for you, Jill, at the end here. I guess I'm aware that we focused on the dynamic occurring between myself and the patient. And I'm wondering if we were just to focus on the patient, do you have any thoughts about what might be happening for him here?
Well, I think firstly, I would conceptualize this patient within a trauma model because he's been exposed to a great deal of domestic violence, which would have been very frightening for him. And yet he was called upon to be big and strong and protect his mother long before he was ready to be big and strong. And I think he then entered into some identification with his father and started channeling the aggression and disowning the vulnerability that I think I would be thinking about trauma and its effects in terms of dissociation and integrated self states. So that way of thinking. But I would also keep a more traditional psychoanalytic model in mind concerning the eroticization of aggression and how this very frequently leads to ritualized patterns of relating. So you often get that ritualized way of relating. And so I'm now going to end, ironically, with one of our rituals and say how important it is for the three of us to continue to be three associated.
You have been listening to Three Associating, a podcast on relational psychoanalytic supervision with Jill, Rachel, and myself, Andy.
See you next time.